For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Why don't we pray together really quick first? By the way, my name is Brian Gardner. That says it right there. I'm one of the pastoral counselors here at Xenos. And today we're going to talk about what you can do to raise your children to be sexually healthy people. So we're not just going to talk about the dangers. We're going to talk about what steps do we do to prevent those dangers. And we will talk a lot about pornography because it's a big deal. So let's pray together. Father, thank you that you created sex. And you created it to be enjoyed in the context you created it for. You created it for our pleasure, for our satisfaction, and so that we would know what it's like to be you. That we would know that one flesh union. And I just pray today, Lord, that as we talk through these issues, which are very difficult for us, sometimes very scary, and can kind of get up in your face about what it is we're doing, I just pray, Lord, that we would see through the glass to what you're trying to do in our lives, in the church, and to show the watching world, Lord, what healthy sexuality looks like. So we just thank you for these folks that have come out to hear about it today. In Christ's name, amen. All right. Well, you know, this is a conference about apologetics, about how the church interacts with the watching world. And you might wonder, well, what does this topic even have to do with that? I mean, obviously, we just give this talk, or some version of it, every year. You know, they just add me to the schedule no matter what the topic. But I think this actually has something to do with apologetics. I think that the evidence of healthy sexuality in your lives and in the lives of your growing children speaks to the heart of those in our world who are looking for satisfaction in their sexual lives, but they're not finding it. You know, the world understands physical pleasure. And it understands conquest, and it understands treatment, you know, and all those wonderful nerve endings that God has given us. But the world is fundamentally, when you ask them, the world is fundamentally dissatisfied, fundamentally confused, and becoming more and more hopeless. Which is why you see the desperate search that goes on in our culture to find some way to make sex work, and it's not working. Right now, it's let's have more of it with everybody so that we can make it. We're just becoming cynical and depressed. So the impact that your children, and it's a scary time to raise children, but the impact that your children are going to have on future generations will be determined by their commitment to Jesus Christ, by their commitment to His Great Commission, by their refusal to serve the gods of this world, and I think very much so by the witness of their marriages and the witness of their sex lives. So that's what this has to do with that. Now, I'm sure that many people walk into a room like this and they've got this question on their minds. How do I keep my child from ever being exposed to or taking an interest in pornography? And you can change that to whatever you're afraid of and don't want them to do. But especially with pornography, you know, that's a big question. How do I prevent? I don't want my kids to see this stuff. I don't want my kids to get involved. Well, in case you didn't know this, I have news for you. Before your kids enter college, they will have seen pornography. It's not something that we can really prevent. And almost every study that's been done among college-age students, it is nearly impossible to find anyone who's not seen porn. It's just a fact. And of course, we know that. We know that porn is everywhere. And you know, by porn, you may want to broaden the definition a little bit. I mean, it's just, porn is the single most available resource on the web. It's all over the place. It's saturating media. And of course, children by nature are curious about sex. You know, you don't have to really do too much casual searching on the web to be confronted with pornography. And so, though your children's initial contact with pornography may be totally inadvertent, not really planned, or they got something that they certainly didn't expect, you know, their peers, the young people today, see looking at pornography for both boys and girls as normative. And so that's where the culture is at. You know, just to throw stats up, 92 to 93% of boys under the age of 18 have certainly looked at porn. Again, the reporting factor there indicates that probably some people have said they didn't who really did. What's really interesting is this other graph, however, on the girls' side. This number has changed dramatically in the last couple of years. And actually, this is an old statistic. This is a statistic that's a good 2 years old now. That number keeps growing. Those numbers are equalizing with one another. And of course, when we see stats like that, you know, we ought to, as parents, we get scared. We're like, oh my God, what am I going to do? And it's, you know, in a way, it's good that you're concerned. It's really good that you're concerned about that. And since you're in this room, you must all be concerned parents. There are two mistakes that Christian parents routinely make in this area. First one is this. I am amazed. I'm absolutely amazed as I talk to Christian parents how many times they tell me that their teenage children have never been exposed to pornography or have no interest in it, or that they've put a filter on the home computer in the living room and so they think that, you know, there I fixed it. You know, it's all dealt with. You know, and I used to get mad at these parents and think them foolish. But as I think about it, you know, we want to think the best about our kids. Of course we do. Some of it's naivete on the part of the parents. They don't really understand their children's culture or technology very well. But at the real heart of it, we expect the best of our children. We want to see our kids in the best light. And you just don't want to believe that your kid could actually be watching porn. A few of us think, in our better moments, we think that the reason for this may be, I don't really want to deal with this because it might reflect on me. If my kid is interested in porn, what does that mean for me as a parent? I've obviously failed, and no, I don't like to think about that. That's uncomfortable. The problem with this response is that it's always followed by this response. Absolute, total freaking out. This is when the mom walks into the room. It's always the mom. It's so painful. The mom walks into the room. The son is there. Everything's out. It's bad. It's the most painful experience for the two of them that they can really ever have. And then I get the phone call from the frantic father who tells me, you know, that the 16-year-old son was looking at porn and mom caught him. And I always say, well, how did mom react? And usually it's something kind of like this. You know, yeah, hopefully it's all of us are barely old enough to know what this is. Yeah, no more wire hangers ever. Yeah, but what that turns into, of course, is the computer is taken away, his phone is taken away, the Xbox is taken away. We've stopped him from watching television. We've taken his library card. He's grounded for life. All freedoms removed, right? Total freak out. Let's think about these responses, because these responses are natural and normal. And like I said, it's always the husband who calls me. And I can hear the wife shrieking in the background while he's talking to me on the phone. you know, but our response is so important, especially at that moment of discovery when it happens. I'll say if it happens, but often it's a matter of when. You cannot simply wait until that moment to decide how you want to react. Because if that's when you're going to decide how you're going to react, you're going to do one of those crazy things. You should already have planned in your mind, you know, and if you're married, and, you know, because I realize there are single moms in the world. If you are married, you and your husband have already got to have a plan of attack here. How are we going to deal with this? How are we going to manage it? My experience has been that an overreaction here, the strong freak-out reaction, will tend to throw the behavior into hiding. This will be the last time you catch him, and it will be the last time you know about it. You know, Paul has a different approach to sin In 1 Corinthians 4, he says, I don't write these things to make you ashamed, but to admonish you as my beloved children. For though you've had countless guides in Christ, you do not have many fathers. You have such, you know, and mothers, fathers, let's just work with me here. As a parent, you have such a critical role in your child's sexual development. And the one thing you don't want to do for your kids is to make them feel shame about themselves. You know the difference between shame and guilt, right? Guilt is, I've done a bad thing. Shame is, I am fundamentally a bad person. Now, the Bible teaches that, in fact, we are fundamentally bad people, but this isn't really the time for that particular lesson. That sense of shame that one feels upon discovery is so powerful that it can drive all kinds of things in your life. It can really be a course changer. You want to make a reasoned call to your sinful but beloved children to live a life worthy of the gospel. That's what it means to admonish as beloved children. They are sinful. They make mistakes. I'm not telling you anything new here, but they are also deeply loved. And if you overreact, it makes the act seem all the more enticing. They'll find a way to look at porn so that you'll never know about it. And the last thing they'll do after that tirade is tell you that they're struggling with temptation. Because you've now made it an unsafe place to do that. You have to go create a safe place for their failure. At the same time, you know, a total underreaction, and we do see this, where the parents are like, yeah, that's no big deal. You know, I see this a lot with fathers and masturbation and their sons. They just assume their sons are masturbating all the time after the age of about 10 or 11. And they, you know, they tell their wives, be careful, you know, when you go into the room to get the laundry. But they don't really discuss that issue with their kids. They don't, I mean, you know, their boys are going to do this. You got to enter into that discussion. Paul, again, his words are instructive to us. He says, for you know, like a father with his children, so he's modeling good fatherhood here, we exhorted each one of you, we encouraged you, we charged you to walk in a manner worthy of God who calls you into his own kingdom and glory. There is a full-orbed involvement that parents need to have with their kids, the kind of involvement that shows them the way to go, that shows them that you're willing to patiently instruct them over a long period of time. Patiently waiting, right, to instruct them. So it requires a lot of patience. It's really hard to be a good parent. That sounds so banal to say that, but it's really hard. It means that you're choosing to disciple someone for a very long time with lots of setbacks and lots of problems, but that you are going to patiently be there for them like a father with his children, as Paul says here, exhorting, encouraging, telling your kids, I know you can do this. I know you can find God's design for this in your life. Your children are sinners, just like you are. And it's really good to reflect on your own inability to follow God as you look at your kids. I think that's the hardest thing for me to do, even as a parent today of adult children. When my adult children do things that bother me, I'm just like, oh my God, when are you going to get this? And then I hear Jesus saying, yeah, you know, I've been asking you that question all week. Brian, when are you going to get this? You know, Galatians 6:1 tells us, brothers, if anyone is caught in any transgression, you who are spiritual should restore him or her in a spirit of gentleness. Notice what the goal of this is when someone's caught in transgression. Is it behavior? No. It's spiritual restoration. I want spiritual restoration because if someone is spiritually restored, their behavior will follow. People can change their behavior and they can fake their behavior all you want. What we want is a much higher goal, spiritual restoration of our children when they sin and they're caught. couple more points on this and we'll move on. You know, if you handle this issue calmly and lovingly, you don't freak out. I know how hard it is. You come in and you go, oh, okay, I see we're looking at porn here. You know, or I see, you know, we've been doing this or that or whatever it is your kids are doing. Your children are going to learn that you're someone to talk to about it. Approach matters. You know, and if you make it clear, and this is more of an overall guideline, if you make it clear that you value your relationship with your child more than you value their behavior, they're going to value that too. Because it's out of relationship that growth happens in children. Not out of directive, not out of go change your behavior, I'm going to go watch TV now. Go change your behavior, mom's tired, I'm going to go take a nap. You know, valuing the relationship. And valuing the relationship often means that you make compromises on behavior, doesn't it? You often decide to let things go that you could jump on. If you jump on everything that's wrong with your kid, and again, I'm saying this from bitter experience down to the present day. If you just find every little thing to pick on and you don't value the relationship, you're not sending the message that the most important thing in my house is my relationship with you. If you're not sending that message, your kids are going to act up. Most parents' goals about sexuality are about abstinence, right? And most Christian books actually talk about how to achieve abstinence. The talk I'm actually giving you right now is the jet plane overview outline of a book that I'm writing right now, a follow-up to my last one from a couple of years ago. I'm coming off the script for a moment. I am really interested in your feedback on this stuff, if there's any way to get that to me. Because I feel like I've perused a lot of the Christian literature on this point, and again and again and again, I find behavioral models, I find behavioral modification, I find techniques, and what I don't find is I don't find love and grace and the gospel of Jesus. Why? I don't know. But I'm going to try and bring some of that here. So, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the great German theologian who stood against the Nazis, who knew a great deal about chastity. He was engaged at the age of 36 to a girl, Maria, who was only 18. He was captured and put in prison and eventually killed by the SS and never ever got to get married. So he was a single man his whole life. And he says this, he says, the essence of chastity is not the suppression of lust, but the total orientation of one's life towards a goal. Without such a goal, chastity is bound to become ridiculous. What a great thought that is. Without a goal, why wouldn't you? What's the point? If there's no goal in mind, why not have all the pleasure you want, whether you're a kid, whether you're an adult? You know, if God isn't really there, if God is not setting an agenda for our lives, there is no point to healthy sexuality. Go out and tear it up. You know, following on from what Dr. Craig was saying this morning, if there is no God, there is no basis for moral right and wrong. There is no basis for a moral direction. But we, as followers of Christ, have a direction given to us. And he says, without that goal in mind, chastity is bound to be ridiculous. Chastity is the sine qua non, the end result of lucidity and concentration. You need to have a primary goal. And you need to have a goal that's better than abstinence, because that's an ungoal. Abstinence is an ungoal. You're not giving them anything to live for, to shoot for, to fight for. So the primary goal should be for your kids to grow up with a healthy, godly view of sex and their bodies, especially for our girls. We see their bodies as men's playthings because of what our culture has done. If you have the goal that what I want is I want an adult who has a positive, healthy view of godly sexuality, if that goal is kept in mind, then how you evaluate the individual behaviors of those children and how you deal with those is wrapped around that goal. Do you see that? We can't make a goal of, I don't want my son to masturbate. That's a really crummy goal, and all it's going to do is frustrate you. Besides, that's not a goal you have any control over. You know the difference between a desire and a goal? A goal is something I can do. So I can make sure that my son has a healthy view of sexuality when he is growing as an adult and as a married man. That's a goal. I can be part of that goal because I can inject that view. What my son does about it is his own choice. And there in my life, God was very, very good in that my son managed to avoid so many heartaches and so much of the pain of the promiscuity of his generation. And when he walked down that, I choke up. So 2 years ago, when he walked down that aisle with his bride as a virgin and she a virgin, I just rejoiced because they could experience something that was just so perfect and pure. All right, forgive me. I'm an emotional guy. I'm not really billed as such. I'm billed as the strong, silent type, you know. But, you know, George Patton did a lot of crying, too, so, you know, I got that to go in. Yeah. So you want to build a really positive vision of sex that's worth waiting for. There's the key, worth waiting for. Because you're telling your kids to wait, not just with porn, but with girls and with boys, with experimentation, with all the crazy stuff that goes on all the way from the end of elementary school through junior high and high school. If your kids don't have a goal worth waiting for, you've given them no reason to say no. You want to give your kids an improved view of other people. You want your sons not to think that girls are objects to be used, which is exactly what they learn from porn, and what the media has learned from porn, and what advertising has learned from porn, and what literature has learned from porn in our 21st century. You want them to have a godly, scripturally informed, realistic view of sex that is so attractive. This is what captured my son. It was so attractive to him that they will find the power to say no to Satan's false view for them. You want them to have a better view of themselves. You don't do sin. Sin does you. You want them to see themselves as better than that. Every time my daughter would walk out the door as a teenager to go off to a party or a date, I would always say the same thing. She got really tired of hearing it. Remember who you are. Remember who you are. That's all you got to do. Well, let's examine for just a minute why. Why is pornography such a lure for kids? Well, for one thing, kids are sexual beings. They're made in the image of God. And they want to be in a relationship with others who are not like them. This is not just grown-up stuff. It's not just teenage stuff. It is absolutely human stuff. God created man, it says in Genesis 1:27, in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Notice where the parallelism leads us. God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. So that's reverse parallelism in Hebrew poetry. And then this is called advancing parallelism, where a third new idea is meant to shock and surprise you. And I think it should shock and surprise you. What does it really mean to be human? What does it really mean to be made in the image of God? It means to be sexual. It means to be sexual, not in the sense that we all think of when we use that word and we go to it. It means to be complementary, but the same. Same but different. Complementary beings made for intimacy with one another. We are complementary so that we can have true intimacy. If we were all identical, there would be no point to intimacy. I would already know you because you are just me. You're just another copy. But the fact that we are different allows us to see into one another's lives and experience and enjoy that difference. Kids are sexual beings because they're human. And pornography offers them a false view, but a very enticing view of what it means to be human. Children's sexual development happens long before they're ready for sex, you know. I have a toddler in my house, my grandson, and I've noticed that his ability to climb exceeds his wisdom. There's a bookcase in my living room, and it's not actually really straight. It kind of leans in a little bit. And so I should expect that he'll want to climb it, right? He likes to climb things. But I also should expect that he wouldn't know what to do once he got up there and it began to topple down upon him. You should expect that your children will be curious and unwise. Pornography is a lure because it's been completely normalized through media. It's everywhere. I don't need to belabor this. You know it. Television, everything. Movies, TV, books, every form of media. And, of course, children do not evaluate culture. Children absorb it. They're not the only ones. You absorb it too. But children are superior absorbers of culture. And they find identity in culture. They're looking to find an identity. They don't know who they are. And so you'll notice that like teens and preteens will attach themselves to different groups. And of course, what it means is what I'm wearing and what I look like and how I wear my hair. Nothing has changed since the 60s when I grew up. We had the surfers, because I grew up on the coast. We had surfers, we had jocks, we had nerds, and it's no different. Kids are searching for identity, and they find it in culture, and they absorb it. It always used to amuse me how my daughter would hang out with these, what she calls punk kids. Many of them came from all the wrong side of the tracks, and here she is speaking her perfect, fluent, very well-spoken English with them, and just trying to be one of them, as they're all, and she could never even adopt to the whole form of how they would talk, and she would be, oh, well, I think that's very fascinating, yes, so they absorb the messages that are behind the images, and all, as McLuhan taught us back in 63, all media has a message. There's a message behind all media. And they absorb those messages in the absence of any critique, which they themselves are not capable of producing. That's your job, the critique part. So what do they learn? What do they learn from pornography and its normalization and its spread? They learn that sex is about the physical. Sex is purely a physical act. That is what our culture deeply believes. And that is something that our culture in 60 years learned from pornography as it became mainstream. And I would love to teach the history of porn to you guys, but I'm not going to do it. It takes too long. But in the last 60 years, there has been a fundamental shift in media, and pornography's message has made it all the way through. Porn only focuses on the physical part of the relationship. And so when kids learn about sex from porn and porn's offspring, they learn a diminished view of sex. They learn a view that only can lead to craving because it's not sufficient. It's truncated. It's like going to the drive-thru to get a double cheeseburger and someone handing you the piece of lettuce. Or maybe the cheese. But there sure is no burger. Just a bun, maybe. You know, whatever variety of sexual experience might be out there, some, you know, more whatever, more exciting than others, it doesn't matter. You're still going through the drive-thru and they're still handing you a bun with mustard on it. And so our kids are learning this diminished view of sex, and having a diminished view of sex where pleasure is key, physical pleasure is key, automatically means that satisfaction is not. And this is why our culture is unsatisfied with all of the sex it's having. Donna Freitas' book, Sex and the Soul, where she went on college campuses and interviewed hundreds of college students who were sexually active, she had a hard time finding anybody that was actually having a good time. But because of this view, they sincerely believe that if I just get the formula right, if I just get the right guy, the right girl, the right two girls, whatever, if I could just get the formula life, I would find it satisfying. And so the search goes on. They never stop to question why it is it's unsatisfying, because they do not challenge this premise. This is the first premise you must challenge, that sex is all about the physical. Pornography teaches us that sex is divorced from relationships. People in pornography don't have relationships. They're just objects to be used, usually for the pleasure of a man. Pornography has had a real effect on girls in this way, because they're beginning to see themselves as sexual objects at a very young age, and they don't understand why they see themselves that way. It's an infection from our culture. The women in pornography are not even real women. They don't have names. In the 70s, they had names. Now they don't have names, unless you consider bitch, whore, slut a name. They're not real. They're merely avatars of male lust. And then, you know, everything is focused in on close-ups and all of this. Their body parts are the focus. And more as you look at advertising, which I think is advertising is the first barometer of what pornography is doing to our culture, we see that the body parts are automatically in focus. The whole fashion industry has risen up to uncover nakedness. And now, of course, we can get it all in high-def clarity, and we can get it anywhere we go, anytime we want. But there's no relationship there. Nothing. And so that's why in movies you just see people casually hooking up who don't even know each other. And that sort of thing, you know, which a long time ago was shocking, now it's not only common, it's banal. I don't even flinch anymore when a guy goes into a bar and he's sitting next to a girl and boom, they go off and hook up in a movie. I'm just waiting for the next scene to come along to get the dramatic track going again and get past this moment. It's become banal. I'm immune to it. It's not about relationships. Sex is just about pleasure. And ultimately, pornography teaches us that as long as pleasure is achieved, since it's only physical, since it's divorced from relationships, then, now I'm talking like Dr. Craig, number three, pornography teaches us that as long as pleasure is achieved, there are no boundaries. Why would there be any boundaries if it's only about the physical? As long as I have pleasure, does it matter who I have sex with? Does it matter whether I have sex with a boy or with a girl as long as I have pleasure? No. If these first two things are true, and you can see this in the rise of so-called curious behavior, bi-curious and all of that, this comes directly from what we're talking about in number one and number two. As long as pleasure is achieved, there are no boundaries. And so now we see bi-curiosity become a part of our culture, making its way up from hardcore pornography from 30 years ago. If you look at hardcore pornography today and you see what is in there, where a woman is raped and beaten and slapped and spit on, you can see the rise of human sexuality 30 years from now. frightening. And as long as the girl can fake that she likes it, and I do say fake, these women in pornography are victims. They are being beaten and abused because they have been coerced into this in almost every case. As long as the woman can fake that she enjoyed it, and as long as the guy gets off, then it's okay. Porn is becoming increasingly violent and degrading and teaches us that anything goes as long as somebody comes. That's where it's headed. Those are the messages. And you can see that there's a progression in these messages to a worldview that is becoming more and more common. And so, you know, I've got another 30 years left on my ticker. I'll see where it goes. But I'm pretty sure I can see where it's going. And your kids are going to grow up in an ugly world, but you know what? They're going to grow up as bright lights in an ugly world. That's the hope that we have from our God, that they can grow up as bright lights. And when all of their friends have become disenfranchised with all the bullshit that's going on, they're going to turn to your kids. And they're going to say, why is it you have something so different? Why is it that you have a marriage that's beautiful? My wife and I have been married for 37 years. It's amazing how many people come up to me and are not just happy, but astounded. Astounded that we would be married that long. Maybe they're just astounded because I look so young. I don't know. Yeah, so there's hope here. You all know this. This is really important, though. This is something going on I would love to talk about for an hour or two, but I don't. The connectedness of our kids has changed the way they look at themselves and changed the way that they relate to each other. This change in how younger people view relationships also paves the way for them to see sex differently than you do. They don't see relationships like you do. Relationships, you know, for the women in this room means I'm going to the first watch, I'm sitting down, I'm having a lovely cup of coffee, we're talking. You know, let's go to lunch. Women love to go to lunch. Let's go to lunch. That's not a relationship for your children. Relationship for your children comes 140 characters at a time. Dr. Sherry Turkle at MIT, the leading, I love how people who do these talks talk, the leading top, she is the very best. No, she really is. She is the leading researcher in human-computer interactions because she's been doing it now for 40 plus years, back when computers were dumb. Sherry Turkle, she's written a book, Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less for Each Other. I would recommend every parent read that book. Just saying. It's very scientific. It gets a little tedious. I know I'm not selling the book very well right now. It tends to be a bit repetitive. But the research that she has done over the years, you know, and granted, she's got a big book because she wants to show you lots of research, right? She's invested her whole life into this. But the research that she's done shows that our interactions with machines change us. And one conclusion that she makes in her book is the self that treats a person as a thing is vulnerable to seeing itself as one. The self that treats a person as a thing. And of course, people do sort of become things when they're merely avatars out there over the internet. When I have 652 Facebook friends and not a single person that I could really talk to. When I sit in the same room with another person, I would prefer to type to them. When I'm presenting a view of myself in my social networking profile that is who I want to be but isn't the real me. We are virtualizing ourselves. We used to laugh when the Jetsons, as a kid, when the Jetsons would talk on the phone and they would hold up that thing in front of their face where every hair is in place and they're absolutely immaculate. We now we have it. We have that through social networking. Except it goes much deeper than just how your face looks. It goes to what you like, what you care about, what you're interested in. If you want people to think that you really care about the environment, you know, you can just like environmental causes, right? It just goes on and on and on. You don't have to do squat about it. You don't have to do anything. You know, I'm just like, yeah, free Darfur, whatever. Show me where Darfur is on a map. I think it's over in Europe. Okay, good call. Go study. Yeah. You know, we cannot forget the fact that Satan has a plan. Our enemy has a plan for your kid's life too, just like God does. He wants to draw young people away from God. I'm not saying that media immediately draws us away from God. I'm saying that Satan wants to leverage and use media to draw us away from God. And I think he's less interested in drawing them into one sin or another than he is interested in stealing away the joy of the Christian life, the passion that they might have to live for God. All Satan really wants, he doesn't care what your kids do, trust me. All he wants them to do is give up on following God. And guilt over sexual failure is a great way to do it. John Piper gave a talk some years back to a group of young people on this very topic. A very frank and controversial talk for a guy like Piper who's pretty straight-laced. But he's the real deal when it comes to this subject. He understands this issue. One of the things he said was that the great tragedy is not mainly masturbation or fornication or acting like a peeping Tom or curious Kathy on the internet. The tragedy is that Satan uses the guilt of these failures to strip you of every radical dream you ever had or might have, and in its place give you a happy, safe, secure American life of superficial pleasures until you die in your lakeside rocking chair, wrinkled and useless, leaving a big fat inheritance to your middle-aged children to confirm them in their worldliness. That's what Satan wants. He doesn't care if you become a sex fiend. He just doesn't want you to follow God. And he's got an alternative. It's the consumption of the American dream. Of course, and the whole idea of conspicuous consumption relates not just to sexuality, but it relates to our materialism. These two things come together. This is why people read Playboy magazine. There were lots of magazines with boobs in them when Hugh Hefner came up with Playboy. What he brought us was the American dream of conspicuous consumption, materialism, and pleasure. That's Satan's plan for your kids. To just say, you know what? This is really hard, this following God thing. And I seem to be failing at it. Maybe I should go into law. You know, or whatever. I hope some of your kids become good Christian lawyers, but so there's a problem here. So what do we do? I only have 20 minutes to talk about what we do. Holy cow. All right. There's three areas here. Preparation, demonstration, and prevention. Let me talk really quickly about this. You know, Christian parents need to prepare their kids for the world they're in and the one that they're going to live in that future that's not here yet. And the schools aren't going to do it. Even if they are Christian schools, your junior high and your high school Bible studies won't do your job either. The most important messages your children will learn about sex are from you, the parents. So, first question, when do you start? When do you start preparing your kids? Well, if the average age of first exposure to pornography is about 10, that's already too late. And really, you know, we have this whole idea of the talk, right? Let's have the talk. Okay, I want to kill the talk. The talk needs to go away now. We're not going to have a talk. What we're going to do is we're going to have, you know, and parents hate the talk. It's like getting a root canal or a colonoscopy or something. You don't really want to have the talk all that often, right? Talking about sex with your kids should be something you can do with them through their whole lives. You don't have to put it all into one thing. Just deal with them in terms of their own curiosity and talk briefly, frankly, biblically. They should have a really good idea of what sex is about before they really start to get all that interested in it. You know, Paul says, "Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord." When he says bring them up here, this verb is in the present active imperative tense. And all you Greek scholars know exactly what I mean now. The present active imperative sense. That means you do it, you got to do it, and you have to keep doing it. You have to do it. It's a command, but it's a command that's in the present active imperative, which means keep on bringing them up. And this word bringing them up is the same word that he uses later in Ephesians for nourishes. No one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes. This is the same Greek word. It's not this one-time action. It's an ongoing thing. It means to provide for, to feed, to nourish your kids in this area. You can't buy a single pizza, give it to your kids, and then wonder why they're hungry tomorrow. That doesn't happen in your house. You understand that. Well, this topic of instruction in the Lord is the same way. You can't nourish them with a single talk. We want to teach them about God's view of sex. This is what we teach them. We want to teach them God's view first. We want to be able to explain to them Genesis 1:27, what it means to be fully human is to be sexual, is to be relational, is to seek intimacy. We want to talk to them about what the one flesh union really means. What does it mean to be joined to another person in one flesh? A joining that is heart, mind, soul, body, all five senses, the full-orbed experience of what sexuality really is. And we need them to see, that's Genesis 2:24. You can teach it right from there. And then we need them to see that there's actually a spiritual aspect to sex. In the same way, husbands ought to love their wives as they love their own bodies. For a man who loves his wife shows love for himself. No one hates his own body, but feeds and cares for it, just as Christ cares for the church. And we are members of his body. As scriptures say, a man leaves his father and mother, is joined to his wife, the two are united to one. We just had that verse. This is a great mystery, but it's an illustration of the way Christ and the church are one. Sexuality is an illustration of oneness with God. There is a spiritual aspect to sexuality. We need to be able to get that across. And we need to teach them this message because the culture they are living in is radically opposed to it. It's not just another opinion. It's not seen as another opinion. It's the truth in our culture that sex is not this way. We need to teach them the difference between committed love and craving. And really, when we think about the long-term goal that we started off with, this is what they actually want. This is what your kids want to have. Tim Gardner, in his book Sacred Sex, says that couples, and I think we can extend this further, are looking for sex that satisfies more than just their temporary physiological urges. People are seeking a form of sex that touches the deep yearnings of the soul. Underneath all of their curiosity, underneath all of their confusion, what they really want is to be truly, intimately one with another person. They don't seem like they want that as kids. They often enter periods of strong confusion where they seem to just want the acclaim of one person. Or they want to be loved by, this dopey guy over here or whatever. And they may tell you that, but deep down in their hearts, because they're made in God's image, what they really want is God's design. That's why nobody's happy with the sex they're having in college, because that design doesn't work. You need to teach them how to have good relationships. Because at the bottom of it all, sex is about relationship. Improving one's sex life as a married couple is about relationship. And you need them to teach not just to have a good relationship with you, but with others, because there's going to come a day when your voice grows quieter and the voices of others will speak more loudly into your children's lives, and you need to prepare them to have good relationships with other guys, other girls. And as they build these spiritual relationships with their peers, they'll experience more of the satisfaction of loving others and growing in intimacy. They'll be able to experience what makes sex good without having sex, so that they can stay single long enough to actually get married and have it. Or for some, maybe to never get married. You know, Jesus Christ was the happiest person on the planet. He was the perfect sexual being because he was able to appreciate people, he was able to be affectionate with people, he was able to be intimate with people and share deeply with them. And he never had physical sex. But everything that's really important about sex, he had. He enjoyed his time with us. Strange as that sounds. He enjoyed the satisfaction of the intimate relationships he had with some of his closest friends like John and Peter. And so your kids can experience satisfaction in relationships that helps them to wait. And it also inoculates them against the false intimacy of porn. You need to teach them the value of living openly, honestly, and transparently. If we walk in the light as he is in the light, we have fellowship with one another, and the blood of Jesus cleanses us from all sin. I think this cleansing he's talking about is not the cleansing that happened in the past. I think it's right now, right here. Right where I need it. As I'm talking about my struggles and my failures, I actually experience again the cleansing that the blood of Christ gave me when he took my sin upon himself and paid the price for it. Teaching your children to walk in the light. We need to do that. And of course, going back to our earliest discussion, punishing your children for telling you the truth is a sure way to make sure they never tell you the truth again. So, if you ask your son, "Have you ever looked at porn?" And he's like, "Well, yeah, I was over at Johnny's house." "Well, you're never going to Johnny's again!" And, you know, the whole thing starts out again. It just breaks out again. Yeah, that's the last time you used your chance. Don't do that. Teach them how much to value living openly and honestly. And last in the preparation department, you need to enter the world they live in. Don't be the distant, naive parent who doesn't know what's going on. Come evaluate culture with them. When your kids want to watch iCarly on the Disney Channel, a despicable show by any account, so much overacting and giggling, it makes you want to vomit. Sit with your children and watch iCarly and talk about it. Talk about the messages that are here. Talk about, do you really know people who just giggle all the time like this? They don't really exist, do they? Why do you think that is? You know, as your kids get older, they're going to watch stuff that, you know, you're not even interested in. You're totally, you know, not that, you know, I'm not into watching The Walking Dead, okay? Just not my thing. But will I sit with my children and watch it and talk about the messages that are in it? Talk about what's being said there? Yeah. Enter into that. That's fun. Make them good critics of culture. Demonstration. I speak mostly to those of you who are married. Your children learn about sex from you by watching your life together. No, I don't mean you're demonstrating things for them. Your children will know, trust me, if you have a good sex life, without you ever telling them that you've ever had sex except for the one time he was born, or whether you have sex 3 times a day. Your children, you do not have to tell them. They do not have to catch you. They do not have to know about it. They will know what your sex life is like because they will see your relationship. Model intimacy for them. Show them in public the affection that you have for one another, the way you value one another and honor one another in the marriage, the way that you are interested in one another's lives. Model relational intimacy for them. This will become, they won't even know it's happening. This is good, sneaky stuff. This will become something that they will grow up seeking. I want to have, you know, wasn't that an old Roar One song? I want to have a girl like Dear Old Mom or whatever. It's true. I don't know if your kid's going to want to marry you in another form, but I think what they're going to want is they're going to want to have a relationship like that, especially as they look at the relationships around them. Because maybe your relationship's going to be unique and unusual. Pretty cool stuff. All right. Prevention. This is what everyone wants to talk about. I always say it for last. Because really that other stuff is fundamentally more important. All of that. What you're teaching, what you're mentoring your children to do. Because prevention is difficult. It's not possible, really. You can't prevent anything. You can do a pretty good job. I want to say, first of all, that, of course, it's funny, a year ago I wrote this. This is in my notes from last year. Mobile computing is the direction of the future. I wrote that a year ago. I am a professional technology person. And I was an idiot then, and I'm, you know, what I'm saying now, it's not the direction of the future. It's the present. Mobile computing is where all young people go for their porn. So if you have a home computer, and you set it up in the living room, you know, facing the window, you've heard all this before, right? Facing the window, right there in the middle of the living room, all kinds of blockers on there. You know, you can't even get to Fox News on it. It is so locked down. And your kid has an iPod. Doesn't matter. You just opened up a mile-wide conduit of filth with just an iPod. Jeez. Isn't that for music? Kids don't even use iPods for music. They use it for Facebook. They use it for porn. They use it for texting. You know, and so, and your kids don't want me to tell you this, especially if you had younger children who are pressuring you, do not give your kids a smartphone, an iPad, a tablet computer, an iPod, a Kindle, or any other mobile device unless you know exactly what you're doing. If your kids know more than you, you are screwed. You need to know. You need to be well informed. You know, and this is where it's going, because of course that just takes the whole convenience factor, the whole anonymity factor, and bumps it up a notch so that I can take this wherever I want to go. I was talking earlier about accountability software. I think accountability software is more important than blockers, because accountability software is your first line of relational conversation. I'm not saying don't have a blocker, especially if you have younger children. But I am saying if you don't have accountability software, you have nothing to go by to know what they're doing or what they're curious about. Don't you want to know what they're interested in? Don't you want to know when your son looks at girls in bikinis or lingerie? You know, when he's 11 or 10? He's finally getting that thing where he's interested in women's bodies. That's supposed to happen. They're supposed to begin to get interested in that. And so they do the natural thing. They go, you know, Land's End catalog, or I don't know, those women are all middle-aged. But somewhere, you know, somewhere they go out there and, you know, look at the bikini stuff. This is a wonderful opportunity for you to have one of the talks about how God made women's bodies special and beautiful, with interesting things that they're interested in, and say, you know what, I totally get it why you want to look at that. God has done an amazing thing when he fashioned a woman But let me tell you where this could go. Let me give you a warning here. Don't just focus on the bits and the bumps. That's not what a woman is. A woman is a special heart that God cares about. See where I'm going with that? What an awesome opportunity to do with your young son or with your young daughter when she's, you know, pulling up the hunky guys. If you have a blocker and you don't have accountability software, you don't know what they're trying to do. I'd like to know my son tried for 3 hours to look at porn and couldn't. That shows a level of determination. Maybe I should put him in law school. Accountability is meant to be something that's relational. That's the key here. I think Covenant Eyes is a great product. Their accountability solution is by far the best of all of the products out there. I would definitely endorse that. If you're interested in more about that, come talk to me. Okay. I am at the end of an hour. When is this supposed to end? Soonish? Do I get to talk for an hour and then we all get to talk for 15 minutes, something like that? Sweet. I'll take my last 2 minutes, no, 1 minute and 30 seconds. Let me make some points. There's a reality here. You can't stop a determined seeker. There's no prevention strategy for someone who's truly determined. How you prepare for failure is just as important as how you prepare for success. How am I going to handle this when there is failure? How am I going to handle it when my daughter comes home and tells me that she was groped by a boy? You know, if I'm not ready to handle that before it even happens, when it happens, my response is going to be based on my makeup, my sin nature, my personality. You know, fathers start going to the closets for guns, you know. Instead, you know, I need to plan for how I'm going to deal with failure. You don't have to expect it, but you better be ready to deal with it. You want to send a message that you believe in your kids, that you want the very best for them, and that you know they can do it, that you're confident in them, that you have confidence that they can be sexually healthy adults. That's a really important message to send. And you want to have your kids have confidence in God's view. It's all just basic, build a loving relationship with your kids stuff. Just packaged into that sex talk thing. There is hope. There is hope, because greater is He who's in us than He who's in the world. The power and the sovereignty of God is just unmatched and unlimited in its ability to transform lives. My life has been transformed by Him, and I am one of the most wicked sinners I know. And God is continuing to change me. The last two verses of Jude, a book you probably don't read very much, are some of my favorite. Now to Him who's able to keep you from stumbling and to present you blameless before the presence of His glory with great joy, to the only God, our Savior, through Jesus Christ our Lord, be glory, majesty, dominion, and authority before all time, and now, and forever. The great God described in the second half of this verse is the one who's able to keep you from stumbling. And He's able to keep your kids from stumbling and to present you, and He will present you and them, if they know Him, blameless. All the stain that may get upon them will be wiped away along with every tear. So, have hope. For those of you who don't know, I have a book downstairs on the book tables. Porn Free, Finding Renewal Through Truth and Community. A lot of the stuff we talked about here is laid out in more detail there, but a lot of what's in here is actually going into the next book, which is, I don't know what I'm going to do with the cover, but something about parenting, and you know, Porn Free has become like my chicken soup line, you know, it's, you know, porn free for dads, porn free for dogs, you know, so, whatever. Who knows what it'll be entitled? I really hope to get it. I'd love to tell you that I'll be standing here next year. It'll be downstairs. It takes me forever to write books. So I'm going to knock off there and let you look at that lovely cabin in the snowy woods. Questions? Go ahead.
I'm interested. You mentioned you could talk about the historical development of pornography.
Oh, man.
I would be interested in that, but, like, of course, doing your research would be kind of tricky to kind of, like, you know, what would you search on? Do you know of a resource that can, like, kind of spell that out?
If you want to do this research for yourself, I would do this, and you don't have to look at a single picture. I would go search up the editorials that Hugh Hefner wrote from 1956 to 1961. It's called The Playboy Philosophy. Go download The Playboy Philosophy and read it. You will be amazed. And it's long. It's a big sucker. I mean, it was editorial month after month, back when magazines actually had words in them. You know, Playboy wasn't like it is today, or People magazine, or anything like that. I mean, there were huge articles. These articles are massive, and they are very philosophical. And basically, Hefner develops his philosophy of conspicuous consumption, because we have a right to it, because we are Americans. You know, he was a soldier in World War II. He fought for this country. He was a strong patriot. But his idea of patriotism comes more from The Lord of the Flies than it does from The Lord of Glory. And, you know, but it's fascinating reading to see him also interacting with the reaction of the church at the time as his magazine is coming along. He drew all this attention. You know, when you put the first Playboy out in December of 1956, there were already 50 girly magazines out there. But everybody went after him because he was actually making a statement. He wasn't just showing girls. He was building a philosophy. That philosophy has thoroughly infected our culture. It's fascinating and kind of gross and scary to see that someone that most people would term a pornographer did that. But I say Hugh Hefner is no pornographer. He is a philosopher. And a smart one. The Playboy Philosophy. Yep. I think there's a site somewhere where every issue of that editorial is downloadable one after the other. And there's a lot of them. But it's like a single work almost. He's kind of building off of the last ones. Yeah.
How do you decide between you and your wife? Or I guess, is there any conversations where it's appropriate only for the husband, or the wife, or you?
Well, that's such a great question. I think general conversations, let's just talk about this stuff, can almost always include both. I think that interventional conversations, you often want to pick one or the other. It may not always be mom with daughter and father with son. In many interventional type conversations, I would be talking with my daughter and not my wife. You know, I think that, though, as we want to just discuss this in general and sit down and say, hey, let's talk about this stuff. What are kids at school saying about sex? And just listen to their culture and let them unravel it, and don't attack it yet. You're not there. You know, let them say, oh, this is what the kids are talking about. And I heard that so-and-so went behind the multi and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And you're like, wow, how'd that make you feel? You know, interview your kids this way.
What criteria do you use or determine if it's good for you to talk to your son or your wife to talk to your son?
That comes from here. Well, I think ultimately it should be based on mutual consent. In other words, my wife and I would say, okay, so this is going on. Which one of us is really going to be the best? Which one of us is going to be the best person? And the one who's going to have the voice. Who's going to have the voice in this? Or maybe it should be both of us. Yeah.
So if the husband's not walking the lever,
yeah.
How do you address this with him first and then start to engage in conversation?
I still think it's possible for someone who's not a walking believer to have a morality of sex that you can influence and that you can be involved in. If your husband's morality of sex is amoral, if he's just like, it doesn't really matter, et cetera, and so forth, you got a hard way to go. But I'm betting that there is a moral basis for the way you want your children to be raised in your house. And if you can come to agreement on that there are things that are off the table, and that these are the things that we really want to get across. I don't think people in the world object to God's message about sex. When you put it in terms of, you know, I want my son, daughter, to have the commitment for a real intimate relationship. You know they can't do that in junior high or high school, right? I mean, you know, so, you know, I mean, it's a cop-out to say, well, until she's ready. You know, what does that mean? When is anybody ready? You know, it's just, I think you can come to some level of agreement and try and work within the framework you can agree to with him. Have you ever seen Tim Keller's book, The Meaning of Marriage? It's better than Sherry Turkle's, I'll tell you. It is a wonderful and very fair and open-minded discussion of sex in our culture and marriage in our culture. And he does such a good job of presenting why a Christian view is not only good because it comes from God, but how it works between people. Your husband may not be a walking believer, but he may be a pragmatist. And so some of the stuff that Keller shares in that book, you could sit down with any non-Christian and read through it and they wouldn't be offended. They would be informed. They'd be like, wow, really? Most people that live together before they get married end up getting divorced? I didn't know that. You know. And then he says, well, let me tell you why. And he doesn't say, because God says so. He turns around and he says, you know, this is a contract. And that's what makes it work. You know, and so he does it in terms that are very good for that. And that might really help you with your husband in educating your children, and then backwardsly, of course, getting God's message for marriage into him. Be sneaky.
The author's full name again?
Tim Keller.
Mm-hmm. I like
him. Yeah, as long as he thinks it was his idea, you're good. I know you know how to do that. All women do. I don't know how they... I haven't figured out how they do it yet. Yeah.
This girl wanted to give a comment and say thank you because I'm not a parent, but I end up parenting a lot of kids and I mentor.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very ingrained in the urban youth and just the sexuality in urban youth is crazy.
Yeah.
And it reaffirms some of the approaches that my fellow brothers and sisters are taking with them, but it also points out some areas of weakness with trying to correct behavior without giving them the message that God loves them and playing them back to what he says about marriage. I don't know. It's helpful. So.
Great. Cool. Thank you very much. And yeah, hats off to you for your work with the urban youth. I mean, I think the more desperate sometimes the situation is, the more the real thing comes along as good news. And I think that those are kids that are going to be doing some pretty awesome stuff once they get it. Yeah. Very sweet. All right, well, lunch approaches. Tummies are rumbling. That donut didn't hold you. I knew it wouldn't. Let's pray. Father, again, we just thank you. We thank you that we can have confidence not only in your design for sex, Lord, but we can also have confidence in your power and your goodness and your love toward us. As we look to our own families, and you know, now I'm looking at my grandson and wondering, what's the world going to be like for him? And I know that it's good that he is in the world. It's not a bad thing that he came into a fallen, messed up world. It's good that he's here so that he can represent you. I just pray, Lord, that all of us would become the kind of mentors and teachers of others that would bring about real change and health in their lives. So thank you for being here with us. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.